The New Statesman.
In 2022, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees announced that for the first time since records had begun, 100 million people were displaced by war, violence, persecution, and human rights abuses. No one wants to leave their home, but for many, the threat of death, danger, and destruction leaves them with very little choice. But where can they go? And where will they be met with humanity? I'm Sarah Darwood, Senior Associate Editor at The New Statesman, and you're listening to The New Statesman podcast. I was joined recently by Armaan Azadi, author of the new book, Across Mountains, Land and Sea, which details the journey he was forced to make over 20 years ago as a child due to the threat of the Taliban. After leaving Afghanistan, he spent two treacherous years travelling across the world before ultimately ending up in the UK as a refugee. But as we go on to hear in this podcast, this was just the beginning of Armaan's journey and the obstacles he faced in building a new life in an unknown country. Armaan has since worked with charities.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Governments and the United Nations to advise on policies concerning displaced children whose lives have been torn apart by war and conflict. Armaan's book has been written under a pseudonym, and we have distorted his voice in this interview to protect his anonymity. So starting at the beginning of Armaan's story, when did he become aware that he was going to have to leave Afghanistan?
Yeah, so this was some 24 years ago now. So what I remember from my childhood is, I still remember quite vividly, is the sounds of machine guns breaking in the middle of the night and echoing across the valleys. And then if it wasn't that, then it would be the fear of that happening. And the war was happening and the conflict was constant. So we would, it was sort of a normal, not normal, but it was sort of a routine of running from one place to another, from one village to another. So when I left eventually for a lot further destination, I did not know what I was going that far.
It wasn't until Armaan reached Turkey months later that he realised he wouldn't be returning to Afghanistan. Up until this point, he had also been travelling with many families and children who had also left his village or the surrounding villages of where he grew up.
And then I lost them as well. So by the time I was in sort of across Turkey border, they were no longer there. So there were other people. Again, we would always find other people and mostly from people of my background. But it was random people from random places, from many different nationalities. And then you would lose them along the way, and then you would be with other random people. Yes.
Armaan left home when he was 12 years old and spent nearly 2 years travelling before ending up in the UK. He estimates that they probably passed through Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, Greece, Italy, and France. But while travelling as a child and not knowing anything about these countries and regions, it wasn't always clear. Multiple times on this journey, Armaan and those he was with were discovered by authorities, detained, and sometimes beaten. When they arrived in Turkey, they were detained in Istanbul to be deported. There were about 70 people waiting in the detention centre when an official announced that they would not be deported after all. But before the relief of this decision had sunk in, they were told that they still needed to leave the country.
And if next time you're brought here, then you would be sent back. So that sent out a panic across sort of all these people to go somewhere that actually we would not be sent back. Then tried westward.
Aman tried 6 or 7 times to leave Turkey, headed for Greece and sometimes Bulgaria. But each time he was caught, beaten and sent back to Turkey. After multiple failed attempts, he and 2 other boys, Bilal and Nemat, acquired an inflatable dinghy, the type that people play with in swimming pools, Aman tells me.
Probably just after dark when we started, and then we kept going sometime in the middle of the night or past maybe early morning, that the rain, the thunder, the lightning and the storm intensified. It was sort of at the beginning, it wasn't raining, but it wasn't clear sky. So when that intensified, we lost the track of the dinghy, if you like, where we would go. The storm was so bad that we could not do anymore. It was just being thrown away by the storm wherever it would take us. Sometimes we would see lights in some far distant places, and sometimes we wouldn't see. It was just the sound of crashing waves.
As the storm raged on, the boys began to lose hope. They'd become disorientated. Their boat was deflating, and a cruise ship had passed by but not spotted them or stopped. Instead, it created intense waves that almost capsized them.
It got to the point where exhaustion, the fear and the darkness and the thunder was intensifying, and I felt like maybe these guys are right and maybe there is no hope.
After about 20 hours at sea, when nearly all hope had been lost, Aman, Bilal and Nemat reached land. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on The New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2001, at the age of 14, Aman started school in the UK. This was the same week that the 9/11 terrorist attacks took place.
It was difficult. It was in... So the first week... So I went to school in the second week of September. So it was the same week this tragedy of 9/11 happened. And... But I did not know about this whole thing. I did not speak English. I did not know about this global affairs. So I had no idea what had happened.
We're just getting reports in now that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center.
2 planes have crashed into the World Trade Center in New York.
There have been a series of terrorist attacks in the United States.
Pictures just in showed the building already on fire with smoke billowing from the upper floors.
Again, perhaps the second week of my, or first week of my attendance in my new school, some guys would say, where are you from Afghanistan? And they would say, like, where is bin Laden? So these sort of questions, this sort of difficult situation for being from Afghanistan existed. But I think it's important to mention that those were sort of isolated and minority of people.
But even though this bullying came from a minority of people, it must have been incredibly distressing for Arman, not being able to understand his schoolmates and what they were saying to him.
Well, I think everything was difficult because if you do not know the language and you do not know the country and the culture, then you don't know what you're doing. And it was difficult to begin with, but I quickly learned. I quickly picked up the language and I quickly also learned about slowly about the country and the people and made progress with my education.
And Arman really did make astounding progress. He learned English within a few years. He excelled at school, went on to university, and then did a master's degree in political theory at the London School of Economics. After university, he began working with refugees and asylum seekers, many of whom were children, just like he had been when he had travelled from Afghanistan to the UK. How did it suddenly feel to be on the other side of this situation?
It's also, for me, I think it was difficult to work with displaced people because it's not just work that you do, it's sort of free living and the deeper understanding that you have what they are going through cannot be detached when you're not working. So particularly in Rwanda, after several years of working with displaced populations, having seen and experiencing or reliving some of those experiences, seeing so much suffering, had impacted me and my own mental health. But in terms of the reward that you get, I think you're making a real difference, a difference that you're seeing it and the people that you're helping, particularly I was working with young people and I think working with them and empowering them and giving them a hope not would only change their lives, but also the lives of the people around them and what they can do with it.
Mental health is a big theme in Arman's book, firstly speaking about his struggle with his own mental health when he was a teenager living in the UK, and then recognising similarities in refugees who he had worked with as an adult. 1 in 5 refugees and asylum seekers are living with mental health issues. Is this an area that Arman feels there should be more support for in the UK?
The need, I think, is always there. But this is a very difficult environment, both in terms of having those resources to provide, but also for the people to accept it, the sort of the stigma and the cultural background that they come from, and having those idea about mental health. I think it's a complex area, but in terms of would they need more help, I think, yes, you know, more support and help in this area would be very useful for them.
Since 2012, 10 years after Arman arrived in the UK, we've had what the government has referred to as a hostile environment policy, brought in by Theresa May, the then Home Secretary. However, at this time, Arman was not living in the UK. Rather, in his words, he was dealing with the hostile environment created by the Australian government against refugees. Whilst living in Australia, Arman was working with refugees who had been detained and transferred from offshore processing centres located on islands including Christmas Island, Nauru and Manus Island. The impact of this kind of policy environment can be disastrous, and Australia has seen an increase in refugee suicide attempts in the past few years. I want to know if Arman sees parallels in what he experienced with Australia's policies around offshore processing and what the UK is going through now.
Yes, I think that's, sometimes I just feel as if this is a copycat of what happened there. The rhetoric of stop the boats, it was similarly there, stop the boats.
So I welcome the Prime Minister's last minute conversion to common sense on this subject. I do point out though, that Nauru was just one of 3 critical elements in the coalition's plan to stop the boats, one of the 3 critical elements in the Howard government's solution to the problem of stopping the boats now.
And also it's break the business model of the criminal gangs, which I hear that now in this country, and the, you know, what they're not coming from, you know, they're bogus asylum seekers and so on. So it's a very similar rhetoric, and it's a similar approach in terms of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda, which is quite further away than what they, the Australians send it to, for example, Christmas Island. So it seems as if there has been some being inspired by the Australian approach.
The UK government's Rwanda bill has been going back and forth in Parliament for the past couple of years, and it's had several challenges by the European Court of Human Rights and the UN. Last week, the bill was finally passed, and the government has said that the first flight will take off in 10 to 12 weeks. This weekend, it was reported that detentions for the flights will begin within weeks. What would Armand say if he could speak to James Cleverly, the Home Secretary?
Well, I think this whole Rwanda bill is embarrassing and I think shambolic, because first, it perhaps wouldn't solve that problem that people would not come here because they would go to Rwanda. People have no choice. They would still come until they end up in Rwanda. So sending everyone who arrives here to Rwanda. And then the misery that it would create, I'm afraid, I worry that the level of misery and agony of putting people on the plane and then sending them to Rwanda and the mental health and the impact that it might have. But I think the damage is, it could be more than that. It wouldn't be just the last lives of vulnerable people, but also I think it would be damaging to the international standing of the United Kingdom. This country has always been a very caring, compassionate, and open-minded. People know this country as, you know, the standing up against like the Nazis, the international terrorism or the dictators, but those are the sort of greater things the British people want their government to do rather than turning all its power on some of the most vulnerable people on the planet and then making an example out of them for seeking asylum. What, in my view, would solve the problem is perhaps using some of the energy and influence and power that the leaders might have is to promote peace. And then if there are peace, people wouldn't have to leave their homes and to tackle some of the greater problems, such as environmental and existential problems, such as environmental issues. What about our foreign policies? What do they do with people's communities? What about our weapons? Where are they going? Because these communities who are, you know, the people like me who fled, they cannot make those weapons. And these weapons, where are they coming from? And I think the problem can be solved by doing things morally, ethically, but seeing in a bigger picture as sort of a whole humanity by just shutting the border or penalizing asylum seekers, it wouldn't solve the problem. People are saying, if they have no choice, if their communities are being destroyed, if they are being persecuted, then they would have no choice until they are being persecuted elsewhere. They would still go. You know, I would say, think about the misery of those people and the suffering created. Do you want this to be your legacy?
In his book, Armand quotes the British Somali poet Walson Shire. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. And as Armand has said throughout our conversation, people around the world are forced to flee. They don't want to leave their home countries. Due to war and conflict, his own home never felt safe. And that's why he had to undertake such a horrendous, treacherous journey. He also speaks profoundly in his book about how Western governments supply the weapons that enable war to continue. At this moment in time, we're seeing horrifying levels of death and destruction around the world including in the Middle East with the Israel-Gaza conflict. What would Arman want to say to the governments that are enabling both this war and wars around the world?
There are no wars, as I said. There would be no refugees, and they would have no legal framework in which they could arrive, because and a lot of these asylum seekers, where are they from? They're from Afghanistan, they're from Syria, they're from Sudan, they're from Iraq, and there's wars on countries that we know there are wars. And if, you know, it wasn't long ago, in 15th of August 2021, that the international community fled like asylum seekers from Afghanistan, and they had no time to actually take their comrades with them. So it is that war that we need to and need to tackle, and to promote peace, human rights, and justice, so people do not have to leave their homes, and people can have a dignified life where they are and where they would like to be. They want to be home. They want to get around friends and families. They want to leave close to the people that they know. So what we need to tackle, and I think what is important to tackle, is to get back to those things, promote peace, justice, and human rights. By creating more wars, there would be more people displaced. That's something given. It's not an issue of like what happens away from Europe. That happened in Europe in the Second World War. And the United Nations 61 Convention that creates a framework for refugees illegally, it was actually for European refugees to clear the mess that was created in the Second World War. So it can hit anyone in anywhere. And war is the problem. What we need to tackle, war, and promote those values that is still precious, things like human rights, peace, justice, and humanity.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. If you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Sarah Darwood, and my guest, Arman Azadi. We'll be back on Thursday with the latest from This Week in Politics. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.